Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming to this event. My name is Professor Constance Locke. I'm part of the Department of Management. I teach leadership and organizational behavior. And I also wrote a book, by the way, which I kind of have to mention. It's called Making Your Voice Heard. So it actually fits quite nicely with the books we're going to be talking about today. So this event called Future Proofing Your Career is hosted by the Inclusion Initiative. And also, I think some people are joining us online, so welcome to those of you who are joining us online. Just a reminder to those of you in the room, please put your mobile phones on silent. So tonight's event is going to be a conversation between me and the panelists, after which we will open it up for questions from the audience. And Isabel Berwick will be signing copies of her book afterwards as well. So this event is being recorded, and barring any technical issues, I always have to say that because LSE always has technical issues, the recording should be available online afterwards. Okay, now let me introduce our panelists. First of all, Grace Lorden is the director of the Inclusion Initiative and associate professor here at the LSE. She's also author of a book called Think Big, Take Small Steps and Build the Future You Want, and where she draws on research from behavioral science to provide science-backed tips on how to get closer to your dream future. Isabel Berwick is the author of the book that we're here to talk about tonight, The Future-Proof Career, Strategies for Thriving at Every Stage. Isabel is the host of the FT's Working It podcast about the workplace and writes the weekly Working It newsletter. She's the editorial lead for the FT Women in Business Forum, and she moderates and hosts FT and external events about the workplace and beyond. She joined the FT in 1999 from the Independent on Sunday, where she was the business editor. Her book brings together the wisdom she's gleaned from years of interviewing business experts, reading business books, and of course, having a successful career in her own right. Her book is packed with useful tips and organized into two parts. I found it really interesting because it's got two halves to it. So part one is for employees and covers everything from what the workplace looks like post-pandemic to dealing with toxic managers and balancing work and family, etc. Part two is for managers, and it covers the basics of managing people, how to run an inclusive team, how to get noticed by senior leaders. There are 15 chapters in total, and each chapter addresses a different topic, and also very helpfully, at the end of each chapter, there are bullet points of all the key points in that chapter. So we won't be able to cover everything tonight, which is why you need to buy the book. So tonight, I've asked Isabel to focus on two specific chapters. One of them for employees is how to get a pay rise, move up, or move on. And the other one for managers is the chapter called Up, Across, or Out. But first, before we get there, Isabel, could you kick us off by providing an overview of what constitutes a future-proof career?
Thank you. What do I think constitutes a future-proof career? One that focuses on the human side of work, because however much AI is going to disrupt our jobs, and it will, we will still need people to be people and work alongside people. And actually, I think we can talk more about AI. I think Grace knows more about AI than I do, but I think the message that came out through my book, and while I was writing it, actually, it developed, you know, is the importance of getting on with people, of thinking about the things that we're bringing to the workplace as individuals and how we can best work with others, both for our team and for the objective of the organization. And I suppose the other thing that constitutes a future-proof career is to enjoy what you do and understand why you're doing it. And that's a question that not enough people ask, actually. And so I've tried to raise those topics and answer them a bit in the book.
Yeah, great, thank you. Okay, let's go a bit deeper into part one, chapter seven, how to get a pay rise, move up or move on. So what are the important lessons and practical tips from that chapter?
Okay, so quite a lot of the lessons in that chapter I stole from Grace. I did credit her like a proper academic paper. I think my big key takeaway I have learned for myself and from writing this book is to treat any pay negotiation as an adult-to-adult scenario. So too often we get trapped in dynamics where we feel we're the child and our boss or the person making the pay decision is an adult. And that infantilizes us. We get nervous, you know, we have a perfect right to ask for more money. You might get turned down, and actually part of the problem there is the rejection that we feel because we link our intrinsic worth to our pay. And so I'd say the first key is to decouple your sense of worth from what you're paid. And of course, that's dependent on what you go into. Some sectors are much better paid than others. But, you know, bosses can be quite tricksy in how they manage this. And they, you know, they can make you feel bad just for asking, because it's a pain in the ass for them if it's not the regular pay round or they don't want to give you a raise. But there's no harm in asking. I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is, it's not always about money. Why do you want a pay rise? It might be a cost of living thing, but it might also be because you're feeling unrecognized. You know, and would a change of title, would a training course, you know, would that help instead? So I think those are the key things I learned that perhaps I hadn't really thought about before.
I thought you also made a really good point in the chapter, which is about proving, if you prove your worth first, then that conversation can actually go a lot easier.
Yeah, I think, you know, too often, in fact, the number of people I talk to say, I'm a manager, and people come into my office and say, I deserve a pay rise, or I need a pay rise. I mean, those are massive red flags. And so if you're doing the good work, that's the absolute bedrock for it. But do not expect to be rewarded without asking. That is you will know this, that's a common problem that particularly women make. If I sit here and work really hard and I'm really good, someone's gonna notice me and give me a pay rise.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. So Grace, can I ask you to add anything you want to this topic? I understand you did some research on pay rises.
Yeah, I find it super interesting. So the research tells us, as Isabel says, you should definitely ask and you should buffer yourself from rejection, but most people don't ask a second time if they've been rejected. But those who do go back a second time have a near one chance of actually being successful. So there seems to be something in the signal of you asking that causes somebody to say, okay, Grace is expecting a pay rise. So when you go in, not the next day, but a few months later, and you ask again, the second time, if you can get over the rejection, you're much more likely to be successful. I think for me, if you're working in a place where you think you're underpaid, really focusing on transparency is really important. So if you are rejected, asking, okay, what is it exactly that I have to do in order to get the next pay rise? So organizations where there's a much more transparency around pay tend to have happier and more satisfied workers with their pay, unsurprisingly. But even if you're working in a place where that isn't there, you can ask for that transparency. So thinking about, okay, I'm going to come back in a year. Within a year, what are the things that you would like me to do? And then make sure that you've actually done those things. I think the one unsung hero, which Isabel has also pointed out, is definitely consistency. So being able to demonstrate consistency in performance. So am I consistently showing up and doing the things that are actually expected of me? So that's kind of the three things that I'd add.
We haven't mentioned FOBSAG.
No, you should mention it.
I think, did you come up with this, Grace?
Yes, I
okay.
did.
Grace wrote an article for me in the FT, which I think is one of the most read articles I've ever published. It went really viral. And in it, it was called How to Get a Pay Rise, and the editor of the FT was really quite grumpy about it, because we all read it. And in it, Grace brings the acronym FOBSAG, which is fear of being seen as greedy,
yeah.
Which is a massive barrier. So I'm always talking about FOBSAG, so thank you for bringing that to us, Grace.
Yeah, so people worry a lot about how they're going to be seen when they actually ask for money. So when I was trying to write that out, it took me such a long time to write the paragraph. We gave it the name FOBSAG. I'd forgotten.
That's great. I love that. Mm. I think also a key thing about asking for a pay rise is you don't just go in and say, I want a pay rise. Mm. There's a rationale behind it. Like, this is the value that I'm bringing that deserves the pay rise to make it easier for them to give it to you.
I agree with you, but people who just ask with no evidence are much more likely to be highly paid as compared to people who don't.
Really?
So in a world where managers are really paying attention and they're valuing their employees and they're paying attention to whether they're consistent, the answer is yes. But if you're in a world where you're rushed and you're a manager and you have somebody who just keeps asking you for a pay rise, the odds of you actually giving it to them rather than rewarding the person who's quietly being consistent actually go in the first person's favor.
So is there a gender difference?
Yes. So much more likely to be bestowed on men as compared to women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because women who ask too much, that can actually work against them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's and this is why I think for women, transparency is their friend. So if rejected, say, okay, what exactly do I have to do in order to get to the next stage?
Yeah, interesting. Thank you. Okay, and the other chapter that I thought would be interesting to all of you is the one on managers called Up, Across, or Out, which basically talks about career progression. Mm. So what are the important messages from that chapter?
So it doesn't have to be progression. So I think the idea of the linear career like this is a graph that was made in the mid-20th century, and it reflects the careers of a lot of white men in professional jobs. And actually, careers now don't look like that. And I think that there's been a gap, actually, in us coming to terms with that. You know, we still feel a bit upset or worried if we make a secondment or we take a sideways move. But actually, in a world where skills are developing really quickly, a sideways move might be exactly the move you need to make to get new skills. And I think there's been a sort of slight lag because most of us have still got this line in our heads, and it's just redundant. So that would be my biggest takeaway from that. And the other surprising thing that I think isn't talked about enough is that it's okay to stay in a job, and you don't always have to be looking. If you're happy and you're doing good work and you're fulfilled, that's okay. And what you could do is use that extra headspace for something like, you know, there could be a side hustle, could be educate, you know, getting a new skill, doing an online course, or it could be becoming an intrapreneur. You know, a lot of companies now have what used to be called kind of moonshot departments. It might be a hackathon, you might be able to put together a team, to put together a project. If you have that extra headspace because you're good at your job and you're not still learning, you might have the opportunity to do something truly revolutionary. So, you know, just think a little bit outside the linear progression, because I think there's still a lot of stigma about staying in a job for a long time. But actually, if you can prove that you're bringing added value, and as you know, it takes 6 months to get good at a job. So people who job hop are probably not getting that good at their jobs. And although job hopping is becoming increasingly common, particularly with Gen Z, we're already seeing the data that they're job hopping more even than young millennials. You know, I would say, unless you're having a really miserable time, take the time to become good at that job before you move to the next one. I don't know what you would you agree, Grace?
Yeah, no, I do. I think also when you're choosing a job, look to see what their training budgets are like. Yes. So if you think about entering some of the larger firms, you might imagine that they have the biggest training budgets of all, but actually firms that are scaling, they will have much larger training budgets. So again, allowing you to kind of continue that continuous learning.
Yeah,
yeah, I do.
Is it possible to stay in a job too long?
Yes. Yeah, in fact, the podcast we've got coming out tonight or tomorrow, they're working it, is about loyalty. Like, is loyalty actually, can it be a bad thing? I mean, obviously loyalty is great in lots of respects. It's good for managers, it's good for staff. But when people have been there too long, it can cause complacency. It can cause managers to become too reliant on the people who are like their second in command. It can cause the negative person who's disengaged, who isn't enjoying the job but isn't looking for a new job, they're just, you know, cruising towards their pension or cruising towards whatever else, perhaps they're waiting for redundancy. That is a terribly negative effect. So, you know, that it's a double-edged thing. Loyalty can be a fantastic, or engagement, we might say, can be a fantastic driver of enjoyment, productivity. But the flip side of that is, yes, you can stay too long in a job.
Because you were saying it takes 6 months to learn a new job. Is there any figure about, like, after an X number of years, you've probably been there too long?
I think it depends on the job and whether you're being challenged and doing new things. I mean, at the FT, they used to have a rule that reporters had to change beats every 2 or 3 years.
Oh,
and we don't have that rule anymore. Because, I mean, some reporters do change jobs every 2 or 3 years, but actually there's a value in having, particularly in the kind of knowledge-based economy we have now, there's a real value in having a deep knowledge of a sector. So you might not stay for 10 years, but you might stay for 5. So I think that would be probably my ideal sweet spot.
Yeah, I used to have a 5-year cycle in my career, actually. Before I came into academia, I would take a job, 2 years to get to know the job, 3 years I've mastered it, 4 years I'm getting bored, 5 years I leave.
So you're naturally there.
Yeah, so it's, I think 5 years is like a natural cycle. I mean, I've been at the LSE 16 years now, so I don't know what that says. No, it's still interesting. The job keeps changing. Yeah. I think that's what's different
that's
about
what,
it.
That's what keeps us fresh, not the job title, but the content.
Yeah. Great. Okay, so I wanted, since this is called, there's the word future in the event, I wanted to talk about the future of careers. So in the future, the workplace is likely to include hybrid working. A lot of workplaces already include it. And of course, more AI, more technology. Grace, what advice would you give our audience about how to excel in the future workplace?
Well, I mean, stay technologically savvy is the obvious piece of advice. But I think there's kind of three things that come out about the future of work aside from just being able to master the technology. The first we've already covered, so consistency. So being able to demonstrate that you're consistent, even if you're in the hybrid work environment. The second is continuous learning. We did some research that looked at skills and the price the companies are willing to pay for skills and how that's been evolving. And I think two kind of main messages came out of the skills research. The first was there's no kind of fixed skills the companies are rewarding, so they're constantly being able to, embracing that you have to update your skills becomes really important. And also, which most of you will know in the room, that soft skills in the future of work are becoming much more important. So artificial intelligence can kind of mimic tasks that are routinized very, very well now. They're going to be able to mimic tasks that humans have done that aren't routinized. Well, ChatGPT can do it a little bit, but much more in the future, but soft skills become really important. And I think for me then that kind of leads us to the third thing. So there's a big literature on success and kind of what determines individual successes. And for a lot of people, when we look at the big moments in their career, they talk about being in the right place at the right time or getting lucky. So that might allow you to conclude actually that you need to be involved in randomness. But actually, if you trace that moment in the person's career, and you look backwards, it often comes about from somebody who they actually knew. So somebody who they spent time with, somebody who was in their network, somebody who they were connected with. So I think the value of networks, the premium of them, has become even more important now in the hybrid work setting. So kind of thinking about how you can actually continue to cultivate your network if you are fully remote, and how you can get the most value of coming into the office if you are in a hybrid setting.
How would you build your network? Say you've just joined a new job, you're fully remote. What would you do to connect?
Well, I think the first thing is realize that it's going to be slow. So I don't know how many requests I get every week on LinkedIn for people asking me to do things from them who I don't even know, or I might have met kind of in one night, and things that would be a huge tax on my time and also would be a big effort for me. But if I've known the person for a long time, and if I've kind of seen them, you know, on a number of occasions, even if they're a soft tie, and that's really interesting, so even if they're kind of a weak connection to me, I'm much more likely to do it. So I think when you join a new job, it's really kind of recognizing there's going to be an investment in building a network, and taking that in a very, very strategic way. So kind of, you know, once a week, making sure that you're meeting somebody who's outside your own network, who might be able to not just help you, who you might be also able to help on the journey, and building your network that way. So realizing that this is an investment just like a pension, actually.
So inviting people for a virtual coffee or something like that.
So for virtual coffee, one-on-one Zoom, if you're in a remote setting, is a very, very effective, very, very effective way to network. A lot of organizations that I know now, which I really love, do something called meeting roulette, where you know, once a week or once a month, you can subscribe to meet a random colleague. Mm-hmm. And that's a really kind of cool way in which to expand your network. For me, I like the idea of people going into an organization and seeing people who are doing jobs that they would like to do in 5 years' time, and really investing in meeting them and understanding the tasks that they do on a day-to-day basis and how they can actually get experience in those tasks. And, you know, I know from both the literature and anecdotal evidence that I have from companies that if you meet somebody who's doing a job like you, not only are you much more likely to get it, but you're much more likely to get experience earlier than if you haven't made that connection.
Mm. So say you join a job in a hybrid working environment where you're partially at home and partially in the office. Would you advise a new person to spend more time in the office at the start of that job?
I don't think that's necessary. I think what's necessary is to really maximize the time that you have in the office. So when you're in the office, pay attention to getting there early so you can meet people for early coffee or breakfast, which tends to be something that's quite appealing for people rather than asking them to stay after hours. Make sure that you have a couple of coffee meets set up. And then when you're at home, you can work on your deep tasks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything to add?
Yeah, I think going into the workplace, if there is one, is really valuable, if only because we're all subject to, you know, the bias that favours the people who are right in front of us. And I think during lockdown, there was a lot to be gained by some people going into the office, you know, just getting in the boss's sight line. And the unfortunate truth is that quite a lot of CEOs and senior leaders are people who like people to have their bums on seat in the office. They like to see the people in front of them. We're hardwired to trust the people we can see.
Yeah.
And overcoming that's really hard. And it's actually a very difficult thing to talk about because we have to be fair. There are a lot of people who don't want to come into the office. There are a lot of people who have personal reasons. They may prefer to be at home. They may have visible or invisible disabilities. They may be from a minority group. You know, all of these are very valid reasons for not coming into the office if you don't feel comfortable there. And I think in a fair employment environment, everyone should have the right opportunities to advance, but a lot of workplaces are not fair.
Yeah.
And I think we have to be realistic about that. So if you do have it in you to get to the office sometimes early, as Grace says, the early bird catches the boss making the coffee, that I think just to be quite cynical about it can be really helpful.
Well, yeah, and it's a natural kind of unconscious bias that we have.
It's really uncommon.
You see someone in the office all the time, you assume that they're doing more work than the person who's never around.
There's that extraordinary statistic from the Microsoft survey, you probably know this one, where Microsoft asked about 20,000 managers, you know, do you think your remote staff are efficient and productive? 85% of managers said no. And then they asked the same question to staff, are you efficient and productive when you're working from home? 87% said yes. So there's a huge gap between what managers think and what the staff think in terms of trust. I mean, that's the really big issue, I think, and that's going to be a massive thing in the workplace. I think workplace surveillance is going to be huge.
But is this, I mean, so for me, is this a problem with managers? So because when I think about the time that we waste in the workplace, I think it does come down to a lack of trust. So these one-on-one check-in meetings that managers do with people once a week, once every 2 weeks, and they insist that they're in their diary, and very often there's nothing to talk about. I wonder if it needs to be that managers need to grow their trust in people to give them autonomy rather than us going back into the way it was pre-COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against the check-in meeting if it's a kind of well-being check-in.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to disentangle that from productivity, isn't it?
Mm.
And I think a lot of companies are encouraging managers to check in, but they're using well-being as a, you know, as the reason.
But I
think underlying that, there is a trust thing. So
yeah.
I think we have to, I think if you're a manager, you have to be very explicit about why you're having the check-in.
Yeah.
And I think the trust thing is still evolving. I'm really interested to see where it goes, actually.
Yeah. But I also think we can't ask people to trust people for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to know that this person is delivering and will deliver on time. So there have to be clear deliverables. I'm not averse to the check-in meetings. I think check-in meetings can make a lot of sense. If there are certain deliverables and you're expecting something, deliver it. And that means I leave you alone the rest of the week. I'm not micromanaging. So I could see some benefit to that. And maybe for someone who's working remotely, if you know you have the weekly check-in, you know your boss will just leave you alone the rest of the week. And as long as you're delivering, over time, they'll trust you.
I think one of the extraordinary kind of byproducts of modern work is what they call sort of performance theatre.
Yes.
So theatrical performing work, which is, you know, I'm on Slack, I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm performing these tasks for the manager. And that's become, I think hybrid work has really facilitated performance of work, or cosplaying work, as some people call it, or LARPing work. You know, it becomes a game where you're presenting as a character who's playing the work game, but how much actual work is getting done? I mean, ultimately, I think that's an issue with hybrid that we haven't really solved yet.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And with AI, how much do you think that's going to change the workplace, say, in the next 5-10 years? I mean, I've heard people say technology will not necessarily replace a whole job, but it'll change the nature of the job by replacing part of it.
Yeah, so I think the there's some evidence to suggest that the jobs that are most in jeopardy are the entry-level jobs, the graduate-type program jobs. Mm. So if you think about the type of tasks that can be replaced for lawyers, for accountants, for other professionals, they're the ones that would typically be done by entrants as they shadow the bosses they went around. And I think what that means for us here in universities and what it also means for big corporations is that they need to think about how will they actually onboard people into companies in the absence of those tasks now being reasonably done by technology. So a lot of imagination has to go around there. I think also that there are jobs where big components of the tasks that they will do will just become more efficient. So what you'll see within, again, the kind of professional type careers is that you'll get kind of mega earners within those careers and some job loss as well. So the shares of jobs, the numbers of jobs that we'll hold will be less, but the people who manage to be in those professional careers will have great gains. And I think the third part is that there's going to be jobs that we can't even imagine yet. And that kind of comes down to thinking about, you know, continuous learning, adaptability, being able to pivot, being able to move to other occupations, as Isabel has talked about, even that we have to do now becomes really, really important. So I'm optimistic about the AI revolution with a but. And the but really relies on policymakers putting in place ways to capture the rents from these technologies so that the people who are displaced will be able to be upskilled, be able to be given a minimum income, and that they will ultimately be taken care of. And I think we're not there yet. That but hasn't been satisfied. So for me, I think it's a good news story once we have the right policymakers to make sure that the people who are left behind or the people who are displaced don't ultimately end up being left behind.
Yeah. And the bottom line is build those soft skills. The communication skills, the networking, the relationship skills, because those can't be replaced by technology.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Isabel?
Yeah, I think this idea of AI as a co-pilot, which is, I think that's what Microsoft calls it. Mm. You know, that's, and I went to a big dinner with a lot of people working in AI in companies already, and they were saying, you know, it is a, you know, think about the Alexa in the kitchen. You're already embedding AI in your life without really thinking about it. So they're expecting a relatively seamless embedding. So I think Google's rolled out the Meets. We don't use it at the FT yet, but I think some people are piloting it where, you know, the AI will summarize your meeting and send you the notes immediately, and you don't have to go to the meeting. You can just be alerted to the action points that have been assigned to you. So I think there's a management issue there. So if managers stop going to meetings, people are going to get really annoyed, pissed off. It's like, my meeting's not important enough, you've sent the bot. So I think that's a future of work issue that's going to be coming down the pipe anytime soon. So all of these things are really interesting, but I think what Grace says is absolutely right. And I also think that a lot of jobs, and somebody said this phrase to me the other week, machine minding. A lot of jobs will be machine minding, particularly what used to be called blue collar jobs. So you will be standing making sure the machine or the software runs correctly. So what are you doing while that happens? Are you talking to your friends? Are you focusing totally on the machine? It opens up an idea of more human connection at all levels of the workforce. And I think that's what professional services are really hoping for, is more time for intellectual development, client work. I mean, it might be utopian. I mean, the doomers are onto something.
Yeah.
But I just really don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah. Great. I think we can open it up to questions now. Are there any questions in the audience? And online as well, please submit your questions. So, yeah.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. You mentioned that one of the things that we should be investing in is soft skills, right? But in this age of social media where everything is online, now I find that future generations, it's harder for them to interact. So I mean, have you seen any research on terms of how future generations can build these soft skills, or any research that is backing up that social media is really having an adverse impact on soft skills in the workplace or just in daily life?
Have you seen research on that, Grace?
So the answer to the second part is yes. So people who spend more time in engaged with technology, including social media, are much more likely to have not just weaker networks, but also weaker social ties. I think the first part of your question, I haven't seen any research on how to build networking skills for people who are engaged in social media. I think the only advice that I would give to you, which is advice that's worked for me, because I find it really hard to network, is to just to put yourself out there and make sure that you're actually going to events that are physical and that you're talking to people in these physical events, that you're kind of giving them your name, you're giving them your QR code on LinkedIn, so that you are linked in to them on social media. But yes, it really is just making sure that you have time for kind of these kind of physical events. And the one-on-one Zoom meetings as well have been shown, or whatever technology, have been shown to be quite effective if you want if you want to network online.
So some of the big four, I think, have already putting in place training for their grad trainees in, you know, how to run a meeting, how to network, you know, because I think you're right, and it's not just social media, it's COVID. So a lot of people entering the workforce now spent an awful lot of time in their bedrooms, and that's not their fault. So I think, but there's also a piece here about, do we bring the culture of the organization, do we impose that on our younger staff, or do we learn from them? So, you know, there's a lot I can learn, and my cohort in Gen X can learn, and even the, you know, boomers who are still in the workforce can learn from younger people coming in. You know, they are much more agile in terms of electronic communication internally in workplaces. So there's been a big shift from, you know, I always like to send an email. But yeah, I would say all of the millennial and Gen Z staff we have, we're all on Slack. So there's that shift will come. You're all laughing on the front row. Do you love Slack? So that shift will come. You know, as people leave the workforce, it's a bottom up pressure. So don't feel that, you know, younger people coming to the workforce have nothing to give, because there's a huge amount we can learn from you. So it's not a one-way traffic at all. And social media has huge upsides. You know, if you've got people who are skilled in communicating with the audience, who are your, you know, customers, clients, they might be on their Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok, all of these platforms. You know, most older staff are hopeless. So there's an intuitive knowledge of what customers want that is vital. So I would not knock the skills that younger people are bringing into the workforce.
Yeah. And I would also say networking is such a broad term. It refers to a lot of different things. Basically, if you go to the office and you're doing a project with someone and you sit down and you're working on the project, and then you take a bit of time afterwards to say, how are you doing? What did you do over the weekend? You know, do you have any plans for the summer break? Or that's an element of networking. You're making a connection with that person rather than just talking business. And I would say the more you can kind of piggyback that on to the interactions that you have, the stronger the connections you will have, because that's not going to happen through social media. Other questions? Yes. Let me take three at a time. So here in the front, and then next, and then Emma. Yeah, you go ahead.
Hi, so I don't really have a question. I just want to take 30 seconds to say, think this together. I was very skeptical, to be honest, at the beginning. I'm an HR consultant, professional by trade, so I've seen lots of ups and downs in the workplace all over. And when my friend told me about this book, I was, oh, not another career-related book. I've seen enough. I said, no, you should start at least. So I think what is really, really interesting about this is the fact that through your work, you get to meet so many people working in organizations all over. And what you put in this book is a lot of wisdom from them as well as yourself. And it's so diverse, and it's really different from everything else that I've read, which is great. And also it's really good to see that most of these things here are things we all do, right, in the workplace. And after 10 years of HR, you realize that you're doing things without really thinking about it. You're second nature. And your chapter on pay, I really enjoyed that one, because to be honest, so many people ask me, how do I ask for a pay rise? And they come in the right place because I'm the HR person. And it's not always easy to support them, to ask for that. And the therapy bit, I also say, if you go for another job and it's just 20-30K paid more, but if you don't look into the values of the new organization and how you're going to fit there, you might pay on therapy and that's very expensive. So thank you for putting this together.
Thank you.
Wow, nice plug for the phone. We did not plant her in the audience. Yes, in the back.
Hello. So following the question before this great feedback, what do you think your advice would differ for people who just enter the workforce, and probably what are maybe main steps to future-proof career for people who are like in their first 5 years in the workforce? How would that be different? What to focus on? Also following on the part where I said that it may be worth going deeper into a job rather than jumping from job to job. How do you think it may differ early in the career?
Okay, and then let me take the question from Emma. Did you have a question?
Thank you. This is fascinating, thank you. So, question about career management and risk then. If we, a lot of the discussions about careers are very much focused on take responsibility yourself because companies won't necessarily do it for you. And as people move forward with this idea, really what it's doing is giving individuals the responsibility. They're bearing the risk for their own careers rather than organizations being motivated and really being pushed to actually manage people's careers and help them. So I'm wondering what you're hearing from companies about that mm-hmm. story, really. What are companies doing to really support people? And is there, in fact, the people stepping back and saying it's fine. It's their job to look after their careers. It's not ours.
Great. Okay, so first 5 years or organizations helping people in their careers?
Okay, first 5 years, I would say be someone that people want to work with. Don't give up your own values, but if you are someone who people do want to work with, you will progress more. And that's a really unfortunate fact of life. I think workplaces are much kinder and nicer and more tolerant places than they were when I started work. Get yourself a mentor would be my second, or become part of a reverse mentoring partnership. So a lot of really forward-looking employers are really going for reverse mentoring in a big way, and I think that's really interesting. So if you're not familiar, it started out as the board basically being told by young people how to use Instagram, and it's progressed from that to people predominantly from minority or backgrounds that are not normal for that particular organization being paired with a senior leader, and it's often a very rewarding relationships. And if you just have an ordinary mentoring partnership with someone older within the organization, that can be really helpful. And the third thing I would say is don't be kind to yourself in terms of your career progression. Because it may not be that you progress that quickly, but you will be learning loads of skills. You can ask for training. I think a lot of organizations are putting a huge amount of effort into attracting and retaining Gen Z staff. So make the most of it. Milk your employer for everything they can give you, I guess would be my, what would you say, Grace?
Yeah, I think that's great advice. So for me, if I was starting out, which is something that I didn't do, I would figure out, what are the things that are really important to me? So is it remote working? Is it progressing fast on pay? Is it having a company that has a brand that's very, very recognizable? Is it the purpose of the company itself? And find a firm that matches to those things that are non-negotiable to me, and commit to that firm for a significant period of time, which would be about two years. The other thing that I would add is ask about the type of training that's available within the firm, and is it all provided for you within the firm? Do you have flexibility to go out? What's the budget for kind of training and continuous learning, and what's the time they'll give you off for that continuous learning? And I think then you won't be disappointed. So if you're somebody who really needs flexibility and autonomy, you would choose to go to a firm where the manager would send the bot to the meeting, because you're fine with that. But if you're somebody who really wants to shadow senior folk, you should go to a firm that has a presenteeism culture, because that's going to give you what you want. So really figuring out what are your non-negotiables.
Can I say something about friends?
Yeah, please.
So actually, I do talk about it in the book, and it's not really talked about enough. You know, if you have a friend at work, you're much more likely to be happier, you'll be much more engaged. And if you have a best friend at work, it's even better. So it's good for employers for us all to have friends at work, but it's actually good for our mental health, it's good for our productivity, and particularly in that early part of your career when you have quite a lot of freedom in your personal life to socialise, if you find a place where you get on with your colleagues, those can be lifelong friendships, and I don't think that's really talked about enough.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's critical. There's also a podcast I would recommend, by the way, called Deep Questions by Cal Newport. Cal Newport's written a lot of really interesting books, but he talks about lifestyle-centered career planning, which I think is an interesting concept. Organizations helping people in their careers. What did you want to say about that?
So essentially, I think your question was about the balance between individual responsibility and organizational responsibility. Well, this is huge. I mean, I've got a real bee in my bonnet about resilience and the BS that is resilience training. And, you know, that, as many of us know, you know, a lot of organizations put on resilience training. What does that mean? It's telling you to do more work, basically. You know, your workflows are manageable, you burn out. That's on them, but they make it on you. So I'm extremely suspicious of organizational lack of respect for people's autonomy and their boundaries and the amount of work that a human can manage. I think people have woken up to this, and I think it's less easy for employers to get away with complete abdication of responsibility towards their staff. So I think things are changing. And I think with the whole wellness narrative that's happening, everyone's aware of where their boundaries should be. You know, this is too much work, actually. And when you talk about, and when you're talking about career risks, sort of taking risks in your careers, or were you talking more about us shouldering the burden of the organizational, the dysfunctional organization? I mean, if you choose a corporate career, to a certain extent, there is a level of dysfunction you have to accept, but you have to find the place where you're happy, you know, the balance between that, you know, progressing and that driving you mad. So I think we're at a really interesting point, actually. I think people are really refusing to take on, and again, that's driven by young people. They're saying, you know, I'm not going to take on this extra task you've asked me to do at 5 o'clock on a Friday. You can see it on TikTok. There's some, you know, brilliant, my manager approaches me at 5 on a Friday, and they'll just go, no. So, you know, good on, yeah, hooray, actually.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Online, do we have some questions? Yeah.
We have lots of interesting questions online. I'll ask the first one, which is, what do you see is the role of major media houses in dealing with toxic work environment? What is the role of major media houses in dealing with toxic work environments?
Major media houses? Well, in the, our work environments are toxic, or you mean in terms of publicising, I guess in terms of talking about it.
Yeah.
What's the role? I mean, I don't know. I think we do our bit at the FT to talk about how to overcome a bad workplace. It's useful for all of us to do an audit of our workplaces and decide how they sit. Do they sit well with us? Do they sit well generally? Are they doing work that you consider has purpose? You know, quite often the organization will be amazing, but your experience of it may be toxic because you have a bad manager. And I think over and over again, the conversations I have on the podcast, the conversations I have in Chatham House meetings where it's off the record, it's all about management. Because if you've got a bad manager or you don't get on with them, it will color everything about your experience internally. And that can become a toxic workplace, even if the overall organization is doing incredible things. Mm-hmm. I don't know, would you agree, Grace? I think management is absolutely critical.
No, I agree. And when we look at retention, the reason people leave is more to do with a manager than anything else.
So they've, you know, a lot of organizations put a huge amount of money and resource into making it a good place to work, and the corporate culture inclusive and diverse, and that just falls at the, I mean, it's hopeless unless they're training their managers.
Yeah,
and they just don't.
I do think, kind of to talk about the responsibility of media, I think we've seen really good things actually coming from exposés in outlets like the FT of really bad workplaces.
Yes.
And it probably has brought around cultural change in organisations that are fearful of the media exposure.
I mean, I can talk a bit to that. Sorry, I didn't grasp the question. So we have an investigations unit at the FT led by a reporter called Madison Marriage. And that has developed a really good reputation for some of these sexual harassment and abuse cases in workplaces, particularly OD Asset Management, which was led
by a man who's been accused by multiple women of assault. And it's, so I think that once the ball is rolling, and I think that has already led to change in the city.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, they do have a role. But I think a lot of outlets are really working hard on that kind of reporting.
That's great. Another online question.
We have Matthew Grant, who's asking, what are the best ways to showcase to potential employers that you possess strong soft skills? This strikes me harder as to than for technical skills, where your training experience can speak for itself.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah. How do you showcase the soft skills?
I think the brutal reality is that until you get to quite a late stage of a recruitment process, you may not be able to, because so much of it is online in the early stages now. And there are so many stages. I mean, it is soul crushing. I don't know if any of you are going through it, but I don't think it's okay. And I think a lot of people are thinking about how to make it better so that the whole person can be looked at rather than just a CV or an AI, a video interview that AI is judging. So that's interesting. I mean, I interviewed one woman who's doing a video interview platform where it allows the applicant to answer a certain set of questions, but to showcase much more of themselves. I mean, video is problematic in itself because some people who are neurodiverse may not shine on video. So all recruitment is problematic in some way, but I do think a lot of employers are really looking out for the soft skills side of things more, because they know that in an AI-dominated workplace, what they often call human skills are going to be so important, as Grace said. And are there any other things we've missed on soft skills?
It's a brilliant question from Matthew, because actually it's often the other way around that we're trying to, particularly for entry jobs, we're trying to circumvent people using their soft skills to overcome the kind of competency criteria. So very often we'll say, well, we want to have task-based assessment so the person doesn't actually get to meet people in the interview. But I think that the literature on this kind of shows kind of two things, I think. So one is the use of narrative. So really practicing your use of narrative and how you introduce yourself and how you actually emotionally connect with people. And the second is try and make somebody laugh in the interview. So there's really good evidence to show that if you make people laugh, you're much more likely to get the job. So again, kind of thinking about how you can actually tip the odds in your favor in a way that's unfair, but nonetheless, if it's a job that you really want, those are kind of the two things that come to my mind.
Unless you're working cross-culturally, in which case, be careful. Humor doesn't work across cultures. One more question from online.
Yes. What recommendations do you have for handling workplace conflict, particularly in hybrid environments?
So handling workplace conflict in hybrid workplaces. I mean, hybrid is just a recipe for, I mean, the hybrid meeting is like the worst. I'm sorry, people online, but the hybrid meeting is just the worst, isn't it? I think conflict is conflict. It doesn't really matter where that's happening. I wrote a piece in the FT about some things I'd learned from writing the book that was very popular, actually. And the first thing I wrote was, look in the mirror before you criticize your boss. And it took me a long, long time to realize that the baggage that we're bringing can often cause conflict, even if we're working with very difficult people, and we often are. I think 85% of people say they have at least one colleague who they would categorize as very difficult. I think if we take a step back, whether we're working in person or on hybrid, and just sort of take a breath, and actually, and sometimes conflict's healthy. You know, I think the main thing is to distinguish between healthy and unhealthy conflict, because teams that don't have any conflict are bad teams, because you're just sitting there nodding at the boss, and that is not helping anybody. So I guess my first thing would be distinguish between healthy and unproductive conflict, and the second thing is take a step back and, you know, literally leave the room for 5 minutes. Is a tip I picked up far too late in my career, having sobbed, shouted, or sulked through. You know, if you just say, I'm just gonna take 5 minutes and I'll be back, that breaks the spell. So I've applied that very effectively. Grace, have you got any tips for conflict?
I don't, but I remember about 5 years ago scrolling through the courses that are offered here at LSE to people, and one of them is how to manage difficult people. And I wish I'd gone now, because I actually would have a better, I would have a better answer to that. But
it's in my book.
One thing I would say, though, you're much more likely to end up in a conflict if you send an email than if you have a face-to-face conversation. Mm. Whether it's on Zoom or in person, it doesn't matter. If you're going to send an email where you think the person might disagree, don't send the email. Have a conversation. And if you need a written record of that conversation, after the conversation, after you've agreed, you follow up with an email saying, just to confirm, this is what we've agreed. Much less likely to have a conflict in that situation.
Because tone is so difficult, actually. And
yeah.
Digital tone is something we haven't talked about, and that's huge.
Exactly. And also, when you have a conversation, they have a chance to say their piece, rather than getting this long email from you going,
what? I don't know. I don't agree with this.
And then they just get angry without,
yeah,
you know, having that conversation. Okay, more questions from the room. There, we've got three, so one, two, and then three in the back there in the white shirt. So, yeah.
Thank you. So I was reflecting on what you're saying about AIs and potential role for all of us as becoming sort of machine minders. And not gonna lie, that sort of struck me, that made me slightly sad, because when I sort of reflect on what I find the most satisfying about work, it's often when I'm able to sort of get my head into a problem, really sort of sit down and work on something, feel like I'm being creative, feel like I'm creating or producing something. And if that's going to be sort of taken over much more by AI, and if a lot more of the emphasis is going to be on the sort of human, interhuman aspect of things, what does that mean for sort of various ways in which people find satisfaction from work? I mean, personally, I think most people would find satisfaction from that, but personally, I wonder if it's because personally I would describe myself as slightly more introverted, for instance, so I get a lot more energy from that kind of work. So is there also an inclusion aspect to this kind of development?
Okay. That's one question. Next one. There, right behind you. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. It's a great Tuesday night when you have this many smart women on the stage sharing their wisdoms. I had some questions about the concept of trust that you were talking about with employees and the rhythms that organizations impose as kind of an extension of trying to see if employees are trustworthy. And one of the things that I've noticed in the last couple of years is the shift in the power dynamic from employers to employee, which may be leveling back out now on the other side, where employees are really trying to determine whether or not they can trust their managers to navigate the type of evolving context. And just curious what you've seen about that power balance, where you think it's landing, and what managers can do to make sure that that's a reciprocal process with their people.
Great, thank you. And then one more. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that insightful talk today. I want to ask about layoffs, because I'm seeking for some sort of advice, because starting this year, I faced, a lot of my colleagues are faced with layoffs in the video game industry. So my question is, do you have any, I don't know, any advice how to build career in the area where you know that they will refuse you with AI, for example, for video production, or with new managers? So any advice? Is it better to change your path and choose just different way, or is it any insight how to rise in the situation like that? Thank you.
Did you catch that?
So, yeah. So the responding to layoffs and threatening jobs. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got three questions. Which one do you want to take, any of them or all three of them?
Yeah, I think I'll take the one on trust. I think the trust between employees and managers. So I think that so for me, I don't like the natural rhythm that is imposed by organizations. So the kind of the one-to-one meetings that happen at a very specific time, I like it when the one-to-one meetings happen when they need to happen, and that there's trust both ways for the manager or the employee to call those meetings and it both to be there. But I think the one thing that I can kind of say to the question you asked about what do we know about the employee-manager trust relationship, we've started to do some research in generations here. So myself, my colleague Daniel Jollis, and Teresa Almeida, who's sitting in the front, and that research looks at how different managers of generations interact with each other. And what's been really interesting is that we demonstrated, when we think about productivity and how people self-assess their own productivity, the older the manager is, the less likely they are to declare themselves productive. But if they're in a workplace where there are inclusive leadership type practices that actually kind of narrow that gap, then we see the productivity, self-assessed productivity at least, actually going up. And that's been interesting enough to me to extend that research for kind of a second, a third, and a fourth year that we've committed to. So it's not a great answer to your question, but I think the question that you're asking is one that's puzzling us at the moment. And if I was to put it down to anything, I think I would put it down to trust. I think if there's no trust between a manager and employee relationship, then I'm going to assess myself as having much lower levels of productivity. And given the inclination of your question, I think it's spot on, that the larger the age gap, the more that's likely to happen, unless people actually act intentionally with inclusivity.
So there's a couple of AI questions there. I think your question was really about satisfaction in work, and is that going to be eroded by AI? Potentially, but I'm actually quite optimistic that AI might allow us to have better connections at work, better friendships, better client relationships, and it might give us time for, you know, reading around our subject. You know, it might free us. We're very bad at what Linda Grattan at London Business School calls effective forecasting when it comes to work. You know, we think that having a meeting is going to be more productive than having a coffee with a colleague. But actually, a coffee with a colleague is a better investment of your time often than another crappy meeting. So AI may free us in ways that we can't even imagine at the moment. I mean, bad luck if you don't like your colleagues or you hate your work, but actually it might give you, I mean, I interviewed a guy once who read a book for 2 years at work because he'd been, you know, he had literally nothing to do. He worked for a huge organization, they had forgotten he was there. So, you know, and he had a lovely time. I think he did an MBA while he was. So, you know, at one end, there's something really optimistic there. What to do? The threat of AI and the huge layoffs we've seen in the tech industry, I think, are going to continue as they remodel themselves. Probably, you know, I think organizational structure is going to change. So the flattening of organizations, the hollowing out of middle management is going to continue. And I think that's quite sad, actually, because middle managers are hugely important. You know, they're a sandwich between the messaging from the top and the push from the bottom of more activist, younger employees. So I think lay off large swathes of people at your peril in an AI-driven world. So I've heard of companies where they're bringing people back, having laid off too many. Maybe you do have to change course. If you're in a sector that has a limited life expectancy in an AI-driven world, but a lot of people already know what those sectors are. I probably work in one, but I am optimistic that people will always want well-produced and impartial news. Mm-hmm. So I choose to believe that, you know, often with these things we get to an extreme point and then we come back to a middle point. I hope I'm right, but, yeah, you know, that would be my hope for you.
Yeah. Well, considering the problems we've seen with AI, where AI just hallucinates, you know, makes stuff up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
Yeah. Should we take one or two more from online and then finish up with that?
So we have someone asking, what can be done to menopause-proof a career that is being able to rebound in terms of scope and salary following any need to take a step back for a few years to manage symptoms?
So what can you do? So you've been off or you've taken a step back for long-term sickness?
Menopause specifically to manage symptoms.
So I think this issue of later life careers, particularly around menopause, but also aging more generally, is huge, actually. And I think in the next 5 years, it's already revolutionized. I mean, my inbox is absolute, I can't tell you how many emails I get, and you probably do too, from organizations telling me about their amazing menopause policy, which often is we've got a fan. We meet in the canteen on a Tuesday and have a coffee and a biscuit, and I'm just, okay. But there are some amazing, you know, I think the need, more broadly, the needs of older workers and what they bring is something that I think is a conversation that is just starting. And I'm really pleased, obviously I am old, so I'm really pleased about that. But I think the jargon term is ROE, return on experience. so instead of ROI, and a lot of employers have started to think about that. So if someone has taken a step back because of severe menopause symptoms, I really hope that, you know, they can get back in a way that perhaps wouldn't have been possible even 2 years ago, because a lot more people are a lot more understanding about, and it's not just menopause, it's caring responsibilities. A lot of people have long COVID and people aren't talking about that, but it's very much present in a lot of workplaces. So all of the long-term things that allow us to work, but perhaps work with flexibility built in, have been helped by the pandemic, I think. Yeah. I don't know if you would agree.
Definitely.
No, I do. Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think I'm hoping that we'll get to a stage, given that people work much longer than they did 20 years ago, that whatever the reason, you're taking a time out, whether it's for menopause or whether it's for illness or caring responsibilities, or whether you just want to go surfing and go around the world for a year, that will be okay with employers.
Yeah.
And I think that there's enough employers who are getting that, that people of all ages want to take time off. It's not just a specific times in life, that then we don't have these labels on people when they do take time off.
Mm-hmm. So I think we should wrap up now.
Sure.
Any final words from either of you?
No, Isabel will be signing her book outside.
Yes.
So if you have it with you or you would like to buy it, please do go do that.
Yeah. So if you could just stay seated for a few minutes while Isabel
runs,
makes her way out there, so she's not so she gets herself set up. Thank you all for coming to this event. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.